I'm Stephanie Trithewey, the founder of Motherland, a national charity that supports rural mums across Australia. Welcome to the Motherland podcast, where each week I share with you real and raw stories of motherhood told by women on the land. It's a wild roller coaster we're all on, so no matter where you live or what you do, remember that we're in this together and you're not alone. So, what's it like to raise kids on the land? This is Motherland.
I was in a state of absolute despair and fear as well, because what I realized was I would definitely lose the farm, you know, like, so it was like I was losing everything.
Sophie Love runs a small farm an hour and a half from Port Macquarie in New South Wales. She bought it herself, aged 40, while single and childless. She never thought she actually wanted kids until, well, she did, after meeting a man that she went on to marry. Soph has always dreamed of running her own property, and against all the odds, she made it happen. But her fairy tale life with her husband and son on the land came crashing down with the breakdown of her marriage just 2 years ago when she was 56. The pressure of drought, floods, and fires, along with other circumstances, had worn them both down. And when her husband left, never to return, Sophie hit rock bottom. At one point, she was on suicide watch. I learnt a lot of other things about Sophie in our chat, including the fact she used to be a vegan for 20 years. The irony is not lost, given she now runs a diverse farming business that also keeps her own chest freezer full of her own meat. But before we hear Sophie's story, a quick word from our autumn season sponsor. Looking for a career in ag? Did you know that Nutrien Ag Solutions provides incredible career growth and opportunity for a diverse range of people, including mums, through their graduate program? The two-year program provides access to skills and accelerated training as a path to technical specialist or future leader in the Australian ag industry. Graduates are onboarded to a brand and network that takes pride in its work and is striving to make meaningful difference in rural and regional communities. The program includes accelerated learning opportunities to kickstart a career in agriculture, professional networking opportunities to socialize with peers and leaders across the business, professional development opportunities to grow business communication and problem-solving skills, and support from business and industry leaders to develop personally and professionally. Opportunities are open in finance, digital, or agronomy, to name just a few. Applications for the 2025 intake open next month in May, so check out today's show notes for all the links and details. And just a quick warning, this episode does discuss mental health, including some dark thoughts. So if you or anyone you know needs help, please contact Lifeline right now on 13 11 14. This is Sophie Love's story. Sophie, welcome to Motherland.
Thank you for having me. It's a privilege.
I'm so excited to have you. We will talk more about this part of your story, but I read an article that you wrote in Mamma Mia and I just thought, oh my God, I have to speak to this amazing woman. So thank you so much. In saying that, I don't know much else about you. So can you just introduce yourself, tell everyone where you're based, what you actually do, and your family, children, et cetera?
So my name's Sophie Love, and I have a very small farm in Australian standards, just 400 acres on the banks of the Ellenborough River, which is inland of Port Macquarie in New South Wales. And I did have a husband. I actually bought the farm on my own, age 40, and then I married, and we have a son who was home birthed here on the farm. And yeah, I run cattle, alpacas, and, you know, the normal chooks, too many dogs, way too many horses, and that's about it.
How old's your son?
So he is now 15.
And so, Soph, I can detect a bit of an accent. Tell us a bit about your backstory. Where are you from?
damn, I thought I hit it so well. What I always say is I'm English by birth, Australian by choice. So I was brought up, I'm an army brat, so we moved around quite a lot, and mainly sort of south of England, and then overseas a bit. I went to boarding school, so that makes me tough and resilient. And there were two times that we had sort of 5 acres, which actually in the UK is quite big. And we had some sheep and some ducks and some chooks and, you know, big veggie patches and all that sort of thing, and horse riding stables down the road, which is where I spent all my time. And I guess those were formative in shaping this. I think I don't really understand humans like I understand animals. Like, I just feel safe and I feel at home with animals in a way that I don't with other humans, honestly. So I moved to Hong Kong. I left England in the Thatcher years, and I moved to Hong Kong for a year.
What for?
Then just to get out of England. And then I came to Australia to do the ubiquitous backpacking experience, and very quickly met a guy and had a very toxic 3-year relationship with him. But that got me my visa, you know, my residential visa. And that was it. I was kind of never going to leave, pretty much, I think, from soon after I arrived. The light, the space. Australia then, Bob Hawke's Australia, was like the antithesis to Maggie Thatcher's England. And it just seemed like such a place of hope and friendship.
Those 3 years, where were you based during that toxic relationship?
I was a Sydney. I started in Bondi. Of course I did.
Of course.
Because I'm a bomb. And then I kind of moved around the eastern suburbs and then sort of slowly moved my way to the sort of northern suburbs. I have a fairly picturesque past. Yeah, then sort of ended up slowly moving up as far as Palm Beach. And then I actually went back to the UK for what I thought was going to be 6 months and turned out to be 6 years, and acquired 2 horses and a dog and a house. And then I opened up my passport one day, I don't even know why, in the middle of winter, and went, am I allowed to swear on this podcast?
Yep.
Fuck, I've got my residential visa runs out in 6 months. And I was like, well, Australia was always going to be home. So, and the whole time I was in the UK working in offices and the rain lashing down on the windows, I would be secretly on Google in those days looking at farms for sale in Australia. So I think like there was always this thing that I was going to have land in Australia. And so I had to work out how to ship 2 horses and a dog and myself to Australia in less than 6 months. And by sheer bloody mindedness and the help of amazing friends, I did it. And then I landed in Australia. The horses were in quarantine. The dogs were in quarantine. And the dog was in quarantine. And the horses, they kept calling me and they said, where are we delivering these horses to in like six, I think it was about 6 weeks time. And I was just like, don't know yet, let you know. And then 2 weeks out, they were like, where are we delivering these horses to? And I was like, don't know yet, let you know. As soon as I know, let you know. And so I was trying to sort of, I was applying for jobs as a sort of Chillaroo, and they were all like, well, can you crack a whip? And I was like, can't crack a whip, never been to rural Australia, no, nothing, you know. And they were like, well, you can't work here then. So I was like, fuck, what am I gonna do? So I bought a car, got the dog out of quarantine, got in the car, and just started driving. And I'd never been to rural Australia. The furthest I'd been was to the Blue Mountains, and sort of ended up, you know, winding my way up the coast and then inland, and ended up in Tamworth, and thought, oh, this feels like a kind of cute country town, you know, and was walking down the street looking at real estate notices. And my dog actually had picked up a tick when we went to get my stuff from Palm Beach, and he got really sick. So he was in the vet in Tamworth, and I was kind of looking in real estate agents. And I found this little farmhouse for rent with a couple of acres. And so I just took it so that the horses could come somewhere. And then, yeah, I got a job with the Northern Daily Leader. And I was there for 6 months at the end of the millennium drought. And I learned to live without water. I learned what it is to have no water, you know. And so after that, I was just like, okay, after about 6 months of that, I was like, this is not my place. And these are not my people. So I got a job in Sydney and was looking for somewhere again with acreage. And the closest place I could find at that time, which is 2 hours south of Sydney, was Kangaroo Valley. And so I took a job in Sydney. I commuted every day.
Oh, wow.
2 hours each way. I know, seriously. Like, it was torture.
You wanted to be on the land that much.
I wanted to be on the land that much. So, yeah, like, James Valentine is my hero, because if I hadn't had James Valentine on the radio for the 2 hours home every night, I think I, you know, I don't know what I would have done. So, yes, that was that. And then after 6 months, I was like, I can't do this anymore. This is torture. I mean, it's actually physical torture on your body, but, you know, that sort of thing. And so I set up my own little marketing agency. I actually landed Pirelli Natural Horsemanship as a client, and that paid the rent for, you know, a year, so I could set up my own little businesses.
Amazing.
And then I came here.
Wow. So quite the journey. So where you are now, the farm you bought, tell me about the move there. What brought you up there? Were you looking to buy your own place that was bigger? Yeah, tell us a story of what happened next.
I feel like I'm talking way too much.
That's the point, Sophie. This is your story. That's the point.
So I was in a rental, and I mean, it was a bleak rental, but just the most beautiful people. And I loved Kangaroo Valley so much. And then the landlord, after 2 years, decided that he wanted to sell, and I was just like, I can't go through this again. You know, if you rent, you're always in someone else's hands, and every time you think, okay, I got my feet under the desk or whatever, and you know, I've got it how I like it, and then something happens. So I was just like, I can't do this anymore. And I was 40, I'd just turned 40, and I guess I sort of just had an epiphany, which is, well, I've always said I wanted to buy land. Obviously, I can't afford to stay in Kangaroo Valley. I mean, it was Millionaire Row then, you know, let alone now. And so I just sort of went, well, I can't afford it, but I'm just going to do this. A bit like moving two horses and a dog. You know, I just, when I put my bloody mind to something, I just, you know, eyes on the prize. So I sort of started looking, and I did this road trip with the dog because, you know, being a pom, I thought, well, I'll go south where it's a bit cooler, and, you know, that will be my sort of place, more towards the snow. And so I did this road trip looking at properties, and I almost bought this little tiny gorgeous house in the middle of a dairy farm, which, knowing what I know now, I would have hated so much. You know? And it didn't really have enough land for the horses, but it was so cute. But I just sort of kept, I went right down to Eden and got my car broken into in Eden, and, you know, my wallet and everything, my driver's license, everything stolen. And so it just didn't feel right. And so I was like, okay, recalibrate. And the first Google search I did looking north, I saw this place. And when I was in Kangaroo Valley, every day I walked the dog. In fact, I was a runner then, so I would run. And so I had, you know, a couple of runs that I did. And one of them ran past these two little cute little clapboard cottages right set on the river. And I used to literally, every time I ran past them and did that run, I would go, this is what I want. This is what I want. This is what I want. And when I saw this place, it was that little white clapboard house. And I was like, oh, my God, that's it, you know. But I was looking for sort of 100 acres, being realistic, and this was 400, you know, blah, blah, blah. Anyway, I came up to have a look, you know, big, gruff real estate agent with a 10-gallon Stetson and, you know, typical. And he was like, little lady, what would you know? Which is true. Actually, I knew nothing, but I was affronted. And the place was sort of so run down and full of weeds. And you couldn't even see the river. Like, the weeds were so high. Oh, wow. And, you know, he kind of drove past me and moved the river. And I was like, well, can I actually get out and see it? Because you say the river's there, but I can't see it. And so he was like, she's an idiot, you know. And anyway, so I just loved it. I loved it. I mean, the house, I just thought, this is it, you know. So I went back, and I mean, it was crazy money. And for me, I actually wasn't. I mean, looking back, but I mean, it was crazy money for me. And I went back and I just said, fine, you know, I want it. And I told my parents, who were like, you're completely crazy. And everyone was like, you're completely crazy. And then weirdly, and I don't have a good relationship with my parents, my father suddenly thought, oh, well, that would be the making of her. And he released some money from my grandparents that gave me a deposit so I could get, you know, a non-bank mortgage. And that was it. And I just kind of went, fine, that's it. And I came up here again a second time to sort of meet with tradies and people who could help me realize this dream. And the first guy, who's a farmer who lived up the road, who was 80 then, I guess, and he arrived through the river on a quad bike. And the first thing he said to me was, you know, this river floods. And I was like, duh, you know, all rivers flood. But again, you know, at the time I was like, why are these people treating me like an idiot? Actually, I was an idiot. I mean, I knew nothing. when I think of what I know now, like the 21 flood and, you know, like, so, but yeah, they were patronizing, misogynistic, la, la, la. But the solar guy seemed really nice. So we became friends. And, you know, during the long protracted sale process and all the paperwork, and there were all these questions like, I don't know, what's a fireman's pump and why do I need it? And how do you pump water from the river? And what do you mean? You know, like, so I you know, I literally knew nothing. Mm. So he was the guy that I would ring while I was chasing him for the quote, which took forever. I would go, what is this? And what does this mean? And what's an easement? And yeah, la, la, la. So we became friends.
And over time, became more than friends, I'm gathering. How are you feeling around, like, was kids ever something that you wanted? Because, you know, you mentioned earlier that you'd hit 40 and, you know, you obviously bought your own place and didn't have a relationship until obviously moving there and meeting this guy. But, yeah, was kids something that was on your radar? Did you want them? Did you feel like you still were going to have a chance to have them?
I had always thought that I didn't want kids because I didn't want to recreate my childhood, and I didn't think I would be a good mother. So, like many women, I had a couple of abortions in my, you know, early years. And when I hit 40, It was actually a shock. I had this visceral reaction in the lead up to turning 40 and this grief that I would never have a child, which came as just such a shock to me, because I'd sort of convinced myself that that was not my path, you know. And yes, all my runs were sort of months before I turned 40. I would just grieve, you know, I'd cry and cry and cry. And I guess it's a physical female thing, you know. I guess it's in our DNA. And, yeah, so when I met this guy, we were friends, and he started work on the solar the day that I arrived here with the horses and moved up here. So we were kind of in each other's pockets, and, you know, I would feed him and, you know, he would be here, and he was kind of my go-to whenever, you know, when the internet didn't work. You know, the builder was taking too long, and he was a licensed builder as well as an electrician. And, you know, he was kind of just my person that I could ask things. And we became friends. And then he said I could share his office nearby so I could have internet. And so it just kind of, I guess it was quite intense. And he expressed his interest, and I was like, not interested. And then I had a good talking to with a girlfriend who was like, what are you doing? Like, you know, you're in the last chance saloon, baby, you know. And, yeah, he said that his lifelong dream was to have a child, and I was like, well, I think it's probably too late for me anyway. But, you know, give it a red hot go. That's the sort of person I am. So I went to acupuncture, he went to acupuncture, you know, like I kind of gave it everything I had. And yeah, I got pregnant.
Wow. And what did that feel like?
Yeah, it was amazing. I was like, I look back on being pregnant and just go, oh my God, I think I felt the best I've ever felt in my life when I was pregnant. Yeah, it was glorious. It was absolutely glorious. It felt so right, and it felt so normal. It is a miracle, you know, and you're doing something extraordinary. I mean, so extraordinary. You're literally growing another human. I mean, what the hell, you know? So, yeah, it was amazing. So I don't like hospitals, and I just don't. I'm not that person. I know some people feel they're safest in a hospital, and I absolutely respect that. But I don't. I don't feel safe there. So for me, I didn't want to do the hospital thing. So we hired a midwife who was kind of, you know, stronger than me, more determined than me, wilder than me, and so I felt safe. Even though, I mean, you know, the abuse I received from my family, which again, now I understand, you know, I think, you know, experience teaches you to understand other people's perspectives.
Tell me about what that was like, meeting him, birthing him at home, and those early stages of motherhood for you.
I'd read hundreds of birth stories, and we knew what the risks were, and we sort of, you know, we had a plan, like we were like, well, this is a very real risk, and this is a very real risk, and this is our plan. So it was not that long. It was probably 14 hours. He was born in the bathroom after a lot of pushing. You know, I had a water bar, a water, what's it called? Baby birthing pool thing, yeah. Inflatable thing. So I spent time in that. And it was a really beautiful night, you know. It got harder during the day. And then, so yeah, I was exhausted when he was born. And I recognized, I mean, look, I saw the picture of us in the bathroom after he was born. And what I recognize is the wild animal look in my eyes, you know. You realize just how animalistic this is, and how, you know, we're deep into the limbic brain at this point, you know, which is why I didn't want to be in hospital with all the bright lights and everything. And you know, I've seen it so many times in cattle since, you know, you just, it's that, okay, I've done it. Mm. And now, you know, I need a cup of tea and I need to have a shower and I need to kind of bring myself back into the world. And how the fuck am I supposed to look after this? You know, like, what? So it's such a shock, you know. It's like pregnancy is all glorious and blossoming and, oh, look how gorgeous I am, and, you know, it's all fabulous. And then you're like, really? You think I can what, you know? So I think it was shock, honestly, and exhaustion. And then my husband worked away all the time. And what I understand now is my hormones fell off a cliff. So we got postpartum, but I had my last period at age 44. So I birthed at 42, had my last period at 44. I must have just gone off a cliff. So I wasn't just in the last chance saloon. That was the last flush of my ovaries.
Wow.
You know? So my postpartum was quite intense, which we knew might be a problem for me because I've had issues with depression. And yeah, I was really sad, tired, you know, teary, la la la. And I was on my own. So, and obviously when you're on a property, you are isolated. I didn't know the people around here, you know. I had no support structure. We sort of created one and put a couple of ads in the paper and got some mother's help. So a couple of days a week, I had a lady actually from up the road, and she was glorious and, you know, matronly, and I felt really nurtured by her. And then I had another lady who came from Port Macquarie after that. So I sort of, you know, you have to carve your own support structure and family, if you don't have family around, but that can be really hard, you know. And I think I was very, not lonely so much, but alone. And it was hard. It was really hard.
I'm interested to know, after you know, it looks like you built your own village, like you literally had to find that support and build your own village because you didn't have one. Can you take us through the following years? What, not just what motherhood was like, but the farm, your husband, life on the land, some of the ups and downs that, you know, you went through as a family unit over the...
Oh, it's such a steep learning curve. We had floods in 2008 and 2009. My husband had gifted me the Jersey heifer for my engagement. So we had Jersey heifer, Angus cow, big ex-dairy steer, and that was it. That's how we started. And I mean, Daisy was the Jersey, and she was like my pet. I mean, after the first time she ran away, and I had to go and try and work out how to get a cow back to the house, and I knew nothing about cows, and I just kind of had to wing it and think, well, it must be like a horse. And I spent hours down there on the other side of the river with her and tried to put a halter on her, and she dragged me through the river on my back. I mean, you know, I knew nothing. And then eventually she just decided that she liked me, and she used to follow me around like a dog. Mm-hmm. She used to come on runs with me. And having my son, having the baby, meant that obviously I was in the house all week with him. My husband was mainly away. And so at the weekend, he would come home, we'd board a tractor, and my time out was Saturday. I would just get up, get on the tractor and go, you know. And every 2 hours, my husband would drive over, find me, and I would get off the tractor and feed the baby, you mm-hmm. know. But that was my thing, was the escape of the, you know, the rattle. And yeah, I mean, we just learned with, you know, we got heaps of potty calves from the dairy 1 year to try and build up the herd because we had no money, and it was a freezing cold winter, and, you know, some died, and, you know, you learn by doing. That's the only way of learning. And I think that is me anyway. I'm an experiential learner, you know. I don't know, we bought alpacas because I'm passionate about fleece, and we had sheep, and the wild dogs attacked, you know, built up a herd of sheep, and then the wild dogs hunted them all down one night and just ripped them apart and left them, you know, like, so you, the things that you see, the things that you experience are brutal on a farm. I had been a vegan for 20 years and.
Oh, wow.
Yeah.
Didn't see that coming.
Sorry.
Wow. What a transformation then.
So I just started eating eggs and cheese in Kangaroo Valley. And so I was vegetarian. And one of my worries was with Ben, like when I was pregnant, my son, if he needed to eat meat, would I recognize it and be able to do that, you know? When he was about, I don't know, 6 months, I don't know, whenever they start eating, you know, real food. And I just looked at him one day and went, oh, that boy needs meat. And so I went and bought some supposedly organic chicken and fed him that. And he was, you know, he's such a carnivore. It was like, you know, it was like watching a dog eating meat. And I was like, oh, okay then. So then I became sort of really passionate about what we grew for the freezer. And, you know, the alpacas were for fleece, the sheep were for fleece, the sheep were for meat. So I just sort of went on that journey of, you know, like everything came out of the veggie patch, started getting really passionate about, you know, all that sort of thing.
And over the years, Soph, you know, you got connected to the land, growing your own food, raising your boy. How would you describe your marriage over those years? Because this relationship ended only a couple of years ago, I believe. Can you take us through that part of your life and the pressure that you were under and he was under and what ultimately led to the marriage breaking down?
So it's a good thing we're doing this now and not a year ago or 2 years ago, because my answer would be very different. I think what I now understand, because obviously after any, you know, relationship breakdown, you kind of have to unpack it, and I've spent 2 years unpacking it. I'm now really clear on it. So I don't know if you know about attachment theory, but I have an anxious attachment style, and my husband, which is very typical Australian male, is avoidant. That's actually really, really typical of a lot of men. It doesn't work in a relationship. If you can't have the hard conversations, if you can't say, the way you do this drives me fucking crazy, you know, or the fact that you can't make a plan, or the fact that you won't write a list, or the fact that you won't have a conversation about how we're going to do this and you just charge into things, it drives me mental. How do we work together, you know? How do we make our two very different styles work? And you can't do that without communication, whether it's at work, whether it's on the farm, whether it's in a business, whatever it is, you know? What I understand now is, I mean, really, we drove each other apart. And it's so often the case, you know, what attracts you in the beginning repels you in the end. In the beginning, you know, he was so calm and he was like my rock, and, you know, I was the one with all the emotions and he was always the same, and that felt really steadying and calm. But, you know, I came to realize that, so the only closure I was going to get was on my own. And I think, I mean, my son says, you know, he knew we were in trouble from age 7 that we were going to get divorced. So I think he was more prescient than we were.
It must be heartbreaking to hear that your son at age 7 was thinking that about mum and dad.
I know.
Wow.
I mean, there's so much in my mothering, in my parental journey, that I regret so deeply. I feel really selfish, actually, that what my need to be here, my love of this place, has deprived him of a lot of things. Yes, given him a lot of experiences, but I think that's something you realize as you get older. You know, when I was a teenager, and, you know, when, for many years, I thought my parents had done a shitty job, you know. But then as a parent yourself and as you get older, you realize that, well, how else do you do it? You know, you do your best and you try and make decisions that you think are the best for your family or you think are the best for you, and then there are ramifications for your family. I don't know how else you do it.
I think you just do it the way that you do it. There's no point really going back or having regrets, because you do it the way you do it to survive at the time with the information you have at the time. And, you know, I think there's so many of us that would do things differently if we had our time again, but it was what it was, you know. And so I think we can be really hard on ourselves as mothers, as I'm sure you've experienced. And, you know, it is heartbreaking that, you know, we don't talk about marriages ending. It's still very taboo, particularly on the land. This came up at our national conference as a bit of a topic, which we talked about. And yeah, it's not really spoken about. And your marriage broke down. What impact did the farm have on that? Because I understand that your husband at the time got it more involved with the farm. You were navigating drought, later floods. Things were tough. Can you tell us what was it actually like through those hardest times and the impact on your relationship? Because I remember reading, and I'm just going to read out a little line, but I remember you talked about some of those, I guess, pressures, particularly from Mother Nature, and you said maybe the flood was indicative of the perilous state of our marriage. It swept away our physical bridges to the outside world and emotional connection to each other. Pretty deep stuff, Soph. Yeah, take us through that.
I was home alone a lot. Looking back, I mean, I tried to keep my business going when Ben was a baby, which was, you know, looking back, it was like, far out, what was I doing? But I think that connection and that feeling of being needed in an adult capacity was actually really important for my sanity. And so what happened was, you know, so obviously during the week, I would be driving my son to preschool miles away, you know, and I would never come back. So I would drive to wherever, and then I would sit in the car and work in the car or in a park or whatever all day. So the farm, all the farm work had to be done at the weekend. And what I understand now is, because my life during the week was consumed with, you know, being a mother, making food, or, you know, work, whatever. The weekends, I was raring to get out of the door and get my hands dirty and get out onto the farm and get stuff done. And I'm an improver by nature, which I think a lot of women are. It's a kind of women thing, you know, like, how do I make this better? How do I make you better? How do I, you know, da, da, da. I mean, it's one of the things men hate about us, you know. And so I was always wanting to, you know, improve and make progress and get shit done, basically. And what I see now is, you know, my husband, he spent 15 years trying to make me happy. So not throwing shade on that. So he would come home from a week working away and then, you know, here's the list, get to it, you know. And now that I've been here on my own for 2 years, I can understand how hard that was on him. He was working physically with his body all week, and then he had to work physically with his body for the weekend. That's too much, you know, and I didn't understand that, and he didn't articulate that. I mean, yes, a few times, you know, he said, I can't keep doing this. But I didn't really understand what the toll it was taking on him. He didn't have the words to flesh that out. I was the one who was always trying to interpret his moods and feelings. And maybe I didn't listen enough. I didn't interrogate enough. I didn't try and put myself in his shoes enough. And I think, again, in a marriage, that's very common. We're each in our lanes, you know, and, you know, juggling family and farm and everything is so hard anyway, that unless you have these big, important conversations. How do you know? And so we'd been in trouble for a little while. We'd done some counseling, which, you know, there was a little bit of insight, but you've got to be prepared to do the work. And, you know, I was prepared to do the work. Although I think as well, you can get to a stage in a marriage where you're both defensive and you both want to blame the other person, and you're kind of, you know, you're in the citadel that you have built, and that's very hard to get out of, you know. So I think, yeah, you need to do marriage counseling basically as soon as you get married to try and understand how to do it and not wait till you get to crisis point. So
was it the floods that were now in the coffin?
So we went through the drought. So we had drought 2018, 2019 was, I mean, it was horrific. I mean, the things that my son and I had to do, so, you know. And then the fires came after that. And obviously, so we had to evacuate. I wasn't there. I mean, it's actually quite a funny story because I was at a yoga retreat and went a rare time off farm. And, you know, I would come out of a session and I would ring my husband and he'd be like, "Yeah, the fire's like, la, la, la. Right, we're going to get my son out and all the puppies and the dogs. We had puppies and dogs and la, la, la. What should we take out the house?" And so I would be like ringing every time we came out of the session, you know, all zen and, you know, peaceful and, you know, limber. And he would be like, "This is happening." And I'd be like, "Right, take this. Don't forget to pack that. The passports are here, you know, la, la, la." And then I came home early and, yeah, we had 24 hours to prepare for the fire coming down on us. And then luckily the wind changed that the night that it was coming, so we only got pasture burnt out. We didn't have to do a real fire, and then so there was all that, which was obviously very stressful. But I kept saying to him for years, I think there were sort of about 3 or 4 years maybe, I kept saying, "It's like you hate the farm, you know, it's like you hate me and you hate the farm." And he would go, "No, I'm just tired." But I think, you know, my perception was that he did. And now I understand why, because he was exhausted physically, mentally, emotionally, and he wanted an easier life, you know. And so after the drought and the fires, we both said, "I don't know if I can do this anymore." And so then I started looking for other properties and, you know, started trying to have those conversations. Well, where would we go and what would we do and what would that look like? And what I understand now is he felt, and I don't know whether this is right or not, that if he had told me we have to leave the farm, would I put him and the family first? I don't know that. I honestly don't know that. I cannot tell you that, because he felt that I would resent him forever. And I don't know if that's true. I genuinely don't. I have self-interrogated and I don't know that. I love this place. Do I? I don't know. We didn't have the hard conversations, obviously. And then in 21, the big flood came. And it wiped out all the infrastructure, you know, bridges, flying fox. I mean, the devastation was it was starting again. Basically, that's what we had to do. And again, I totally understand this, because I sort of feel the same when I go, if I look at other properties and go, okay, how would I start again? I just don't know if I have the energy to build a farm, a lifestyle from scratch, you know, because I know what's involved in it, you know, heart, muscles, energy, spirit. And I think he just went, I can't do this, you know.
And he left.
Yeah, he left. I think it was that year. Yeah, I think maybe the end of 21. I can't remember. It's been 2 years. Drought, fire, mouse plague, COVID, floods. You know, I mean, I think Australia, and my psychologist agrees, I mean, much of rural Australia, honestly, is still deeply traumatized and with no way of addressing that trauma. You know, mental health services being what they are. And that's a problem, you know, if you're on property, it's hard to access mental health services. My vision, so years ago, I was the editor of Wellbeing magazine. And so I've seen how complementary therapies have gone from being way out there left field to almost working hand in hand now with allopathic traditional mental health. And my hope is that in the future, you know, when someone says, who's your GP, they will also say, who's your mental health professional? And that we actually understand that everybody, at whether at some juncture or throughout the course of their life, need a bit of help to unpack the hard things in life. Life is full of hard things. And if you can just have a professional who validates your emotional journey and helps you navigate the hard times, then you feel held.
So beautifully put, Soph. You know, we so often have such a reactive approach to our health, and we wait until we're at crisis point, at breaking point, and by then it can often be too late. So I think you make such an important point around having support through those tough times and not waiting till you're at rock bottom. And I wanted to ask you, did you hit rock bottom after your marriage? So I just want to move now to your husband left and you're there on your beautiful 400 acres that you'd worked so hard to keep and were now facing rebuilding. What impact did the marriage breakdown have on you? And you've since opted to stay and farm on your own. Take us through this next chapter.
Yeah, I went as far down as it's possible to go. So, you know, we build a castle in the air about so many things in our lives, but particularly about our marriages and our family. And I thought we would be together forever. And even though I knew, I mean, that was the conversation we had, you know, I said, I can't keep doing this. And I don't even know what I meant by that, honestly. And then I suggested a trial separation. And when he left, I knew he was never coming back. He left like a rat leaving a sinking ship, you know. It was worse than a death. I don't even know how to explain. I mean, clearly he triggered my abandonment wound, but I was just completely broken. I've never been so broken. I was on suicide watch with two psychologists for a week or two. I had a plan for quite a while, and I was in a state of absolute despair and fear as well, because what I realized was I would definitely lose the farm, you know, like, so it was like I was losing everything. And I felt like I was losing my son as well. You know, we'd been together for 14 years, 13, however long it'd been, just sort of really just him and me. And then all of a sudden, he was gone for a week at a time. And I felt like I'd lost him completely. So yeah, it was so awful, and also awful for my son, because he saw me in my rawest, I mean, you know, deep, deep grief. And I had a lot of fear that I would lose the farm. You know, that's still a thing. But I know that my ex doesn't want to evict me from here. You know, I mean, obviously everything's tied up in this. So I don't know how this will shake out in the end. I can't tell you that. I can't see into the future. But yes, I am here. And look, I knew nothing. I mean, thank you. At the beginning, you congratulated me. And I have learned to congratulate myself because I have learned so fucking much. And there are still so many things that scare me or go, I can't do this. But it's great in a way. I've learned so much. I've learned to slow down. I've learned not to be so impatient because you can't be impatient with machinery. I've learned to be much more lateral and literal in my thinking. You know, I can't do this. How the fuck am I going to do this? I'm the only one here. So it has to get done. I got to work out a way, you know. And I didn't even really understand how to use a drill, you know. Now I'm like, you know, drill happy, chainsaw happy, you know, tractor happy. Yeah, there's lots of things I've learned how to do. I mean, last year we went into drought again. I had to sell half my cattle. That was so hard. And then, of course, it started raining and hasn't stopped raining since. So, you know, I got rock bottom prices. I'm still working out how to pay my way. I've been paying the mortgage for a year. I'm still trying to work out. I mean, I've sort of spent 2 years cleaning up the farm and making it me friendly. But, you know, I need to make money. And so I'm sort of at a bit of a crossroads in terms of how, when, who, blah, blah. And I guess I've been, you know, I've been deep in my grief and unpacking. I think it's such a female thing, or maybe it's not. I mean, maybe men do it too. But the need to understand that I've had to sort of pull the jigsaw apart and look at each piece, and so that I came to a place of peace with it. So it's not about blame. But now I'm like, okay, I see what happened. And neither of us are monsters. And, you know, these were the circumstances. And these were the personalities, and we couldn't work through that.
Thank you for being so open about your journey. It's brave, and I think that we need to talk about this stuff more. And I think, you know, I did congratulate you because as women we are so good at not. And I think tall poppy syndrome is real as well. Like, we don't like to gloat too much, you know, we like to eat humble pie and be self-deprecating. That's a very Australian thing to do. But, you know, reading your story and hearing what you've been through and the fact you're still on the land, you're running the farm, you're making it work as best you can, you're on your own. Like, I think it's absolutely extraordinary. So I wanted to say amazing job, firstly. Secondly, I can't wait to follow your journey and to see what happens next. And just thank you so much for being with us, Sophie, and for sharing your story. I'm sure everyone listening will agree that, yeah, you're an amazing woman, and I really, really, truly wish you all the best.
Thanks, Steph. I really appreciate that. And I think women, I mean, it still blows my mind that we still live in a patriarchal society. I mean, how the fuck? I mean, women are so incredible. You know, we bleed, we birth, we can do anything. We're so strong. We're emotionally strong, you know, in every way. We are so powerful, and women on the land are an extraordinary breed. And as you say, under-recognized. But it's so great to see more women taking up the mantle and being loud and proud, you know, and obviously you're an integral part of that. So thank you so much for allowing me to be part of your community. It's been lovely. Thanks so much.
Thanks for listening. I hope you enjoyed today's show. A huge thank you to our autumn season sponsor, Nutrien Ag Solutions. Nutrien provides incredible career growth and opportunity through their 2-year graduate program. Opportunities are open in finance, digital, or agronomy, just to name a few. And applications for the 2025 intake open next month in May. So head to today's show notes for all the links and the details. That's it from me, everyone. Thank you for tuning in. I'll catch you next week.